You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst and peace activist who just returned from Greece. Ray, thanks for joining us today.
You're most welcome, Dave.
The last time we spoke, Ray, you had, this was in February, I believe, attended a Hillary Clinton speech. I think it was at George Washington University, where they roughed you up and cut you and bruised you and handcuffed you and abused you, all for just standing with your back turned to the Secretary of State. How was it that you became involved in this Freedom Flotilla 2 or Gaza Flotilla 2?
I have some very good friends who are among the organizers. One of them is Colonel Ian Wright, with whom I've shared many a podium and traipsed around the country from this symposium to that. She is a woman of incredible courage and incredible savoir-faire, so to speak. When Cindy Sheehan went down to Crawford to ask George Bush why he would say that her son Casey Sheehan had been killed in a noble cause, what noble cause, Cindy wanted to know, and you know the whole story about that month in Crawford. Well, when tens of thousands of people came, they needed a sheriff. They needed a mayor of that part of Crawford, and Colonel Ann Wright rose to the occasion, and just between us, she had the Crawford police as big chums after about a week when she showed that she could enforce what they needed to enforce that was reasonable, that people would obey her. So she's a terrific organizer, and after being on the flotilla last year, she came back in high dudgeon. She was very, very angry and said, we have to have a U.S. boat this year. And she and some of her companions roamed around the country, focusing in New York especially, and raised almost $400,000 to charter a boat to repair it. And it was all shipshape. It was just beautiful. We were all set to go 2 weeks ago when a quasi-law firm, a pseudo-law firm in Israel, registered a complaint saying our ship or our boat was not seaworthy. That held things up. We needed an inspection, and then they never gave us the result of the inspection. It was all, what you call, a frivolous lawsuit. It was all a frivolous claim. Everybody recognized it as such, but it was what the Greek government used to prevent us from sailing. In the event, as you may know, Dave, we did sail. The captain felt strongly enough that this was so demonstrably bogus that we all got on board and we put out to sea, and we got 10 miles out. We almost got into international waters when we were intercepted by the Greek Coast Guard, and after being held there for 2 hours, then came the Ninja Turtle black-clad guys, just like the ones that descended on the Mavi Marmara a year ago. These ostensibly were Greeks, I suppose they were. They pointed their automatic weapons at us, and the captain thought, well, I guess we're not going to get out today, so we turned around, and we were interned. The boat was impounded in a Coast Guard high defense area with barbed wire all around, and the only thing I'll say for the Greeks, shamefaced as they were, was that as soon as we told them that our bathrooms were overflowing, they brought in two fanciest porta-johns that I've ever seen in my life. That way we able to exist. So all's well that ends well, but it was very hard to watch what was going on and to be unable to sail. In the event, they charged the captain, and Tuesday we were all at court when the judge ruled that the captain should be free without bail, and it looks like the charges will probably be dropped. That's a guess rather than an assurance. This was the interesting part. After the captain was released, he saw fit to thank the judge, and he said, thank you, Your Honor, and I thank the government. And the judge said, wait, you don't have to thank the government. This is not the government. This is an independent judiciary. You have nothing to thank the government for. This is something that I decide as the judge, and that's the way it will be. So thank goodness in that cradle of democracy, there's still such a thing as an independent court. And I dare say, however much political influence was brought to bear on that judge, he resisted it. And I hope that our courts in this country can be as independent.
Why do you think, Ray, that the ship was not allowed to depart?
Well, it's very clear that Israel and the United States exerted great pressure on the Greek government and not to let it happen. The Greek government is in dire straits economically. They are in great need of a bailout, another one. The United States, of course, has incredible influence over what happens in that realm. And Israel, for its part, is one of the major trading partners for Greece, and exerted that kind of pressure as well. The idea was to prevent the boats from sailing so that the Israelis would not be able to do what they did last year, and that is kill 9 people, wound a couple dozen, that kind of thing. Nobody wanted that, and the Israelis were prepared to do it. They manufactured all kinds of pretexts to do it, to include the fact that Medea Benjamin and I were, and our colleagues were about to pour sulfuric acid on the boarding IDF or Israeli Defense Force people who would intercept the boats. That was pretty ridiculous. They also claimed that we were saying we wanted to shed the blood of Israeli armed forces. Equally ridiculous. So what's come out of all this is a manifestation of the fact that with U.S. support, in effect, the Israeli government has been able to sort of stretch its 12-mile territorial limit in the sea all the way up to Athens, all the way up to Piraeus, all the way up to the Greek Aegean. It's quite remarkable. And it's no secret. We uttered all kinds of middle-level and lower-level Greek officials, police officials, Coast Guard, were embarrassed, red-faced at what their government, the Greek government, felt it was forced to do to continue to curry favor with the West Europeans and, of course, first and foremost, the United States. And it's just a terribly embarrassing thing. Here's Greece, a seafaring nation. Freedom of the seas has always been a tenet of its outlook on life, and is still required by the U.S. and Israel to keep all the boats in port on various pretexts, you know, inspections and all that kind of paperwork and stuff like that. So it's pretty sad when you come right down to it. In addition, you have people like Hillary Clinton getting up and saying, well, you know, we know that the flotilla intends to sail into Israeli waters, and if they do, well, they'll get their own comeuppance. Well, number one, we had no intention to sail into Israeli waters. Gazan waters. The Israelis don't even pretend that Gazan waters are Israeli waters. And number two, what kind of Secretary of State is it that will give another country carte blanche to work their will on us? It's really very, very strange. And I think that with all the publicity that has attended this, the degree of Israeli influence on the United States as well as on Greece is manifest to everyone who can see.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Greece, the birthplace of democracy. Now, you saw a lot of the inner workings of Israel's influence there in Greece. And of course, you've seen a lot of other stuff in your 28-year CIA career?
27 years, yeah, and two in the Army.
You've seen a lot. Did you gain any insight about Israel's position in the world, Israel's influence on Western democracies that you might not have gleaned earlier?
Well, yeah, I wrote a big article for the 4th of July, since we were marooned on the ship and not able to go anywhere. And I noted that what George Washington, our first president, warned about in his farewell address, he made a big point of saying, look, what we have to avoid as a country looking outward is what he called entangling alliances. We have to avoid passionate attachments. Again, another quote, passionate attachments with the perceived interests of another country as though that country had identical interests to ours. France was the one that he had in mind then, but it equally obtains with respect to Israel. And the people who are running our foreign policy, still, there are a lot of neoconservatives and Dennis Frost and others who are in the White House who are openly Zionist, openly biased toward Israel. You have the major media, the New York Times and so forth, the same way. I was tickled, you know, when the New York Times correspondent that we had on board and was with us for a few days, when he wrote a very good article about what was going on, well, he had to sort of fight against Ethan Bronner, who's the Middle East bureau chief of the New York Times, whose son is in the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and who is anything but unbiased. Ethan Bronner writes this front-page article starting out, two new luxury hotels are being built in Gaza, and blah, blah, blah. Everything is just hunky-dory. The Israelis are letting all kinds of stuff through. The Gazans are hap's clams. It's just quite remarkable. So what we have here is a very pro-Israel media, pro-Israel government, and a very strong lobby, the strongest in the nation, called AIPAC, which is the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee. And they are perceived as being something that Obama just can't dismiss because he wants to be reelected. And if Obama wants to collect $1 billion to become president again or stay president, then he's got to play ball with these guys. That's the body politic. It does come down to money. It does come down to influence of the media. And the Palestinians, since 1948, when 750,000 were displaced and driven to the four winds for the creation of the State of Israel, you know, they're still for three, four generations in camps and so forth. And Gaza is aptly described as the largest open-air prison in the world, a small slice of land which is tightly populated and at the tender mercies of the Israeli Defense Forces, who I understand from press reports attacked eastern Gaza yesterday with weapons. So we were trying to draw attention to the plight of 1.6 million Gazans who are cooped up there. They can't get out. They can't get resupplied in any decent way because supplies really have to come in by sea. They can't come through a pedestrian crossing, which is pretty much what the Rafah crossing is, a couple of trucks a day. And they're suffering. They're suffering very badly. So we thought that, number one, we wanted to show them that somebody cared outside in the world. And number two, we wanted to show that the Israeli blockade was illegal. Now, this is a very essential point here. Is the Israeli blockade of Gaza legal? No one says it's legal except the Israelis. What is the position of the United States government? Well, two Fridays ago, there was a spokeswoman at the State Department that was asked that question two times. What is the position of the United States government with regard to the legality of the blockade of Gaza? You know what she said? She said, "Oh, well, I'm not an expert on law of the sea. I don't know. Now, she said that twice, okay? So not even the United States of America is willing to bless this illegal blockade as being legal. So where does that leave us? Well, by all rights, we should be able to sail into Gaza. But Hillary Clinton and the rest of them did everything they could to dissuade us from trying because they don't want to embarrass their Israeli friends. It's really a very sorry state of affairs.
It's disturbing. Do you think it all comes down to the way that the Israelis, and that's Israelis not just in that country, but the Israel firsters here in the United States, the way that they found to actually control the politicians and the people who make the decisions through money? Do you think that's the crux of it?
Well, the proof is in the pudding. I'm here in Minnesota, and tomorrow Cynthia McKinney and I will be speaking, sharing a platform. Cynthia was pure and simple ousted from her House seat in Georgia by the lobby. Paul Finley was similarly dislodged a couple of decades ago. If you don't play ball, then they will find a candidate that can run against you, and with all the money they can put behind that candidate's candidacy, they're almost a shoo-in. So yeah, it's a very deleterious thing, and it's not only a matter of moral perspective here or decency, it's also a matter of security, because even David Petraeus, now he's the general, of course, that was running the war in Afghanistan, now he's head of the CIA. But 3 months ago, or 4 months ago, I guess it was, he testified before the Senate. And in his testimony, he pointed out the inability of Israel and the Palestinians to work out a suitable arrangement, a peaceful arrangement, is a force for violence against U.S. forces. It makes the situation much more volatile and puts U.S. forces at greater risk. Now, that was in his testimony. And there's sort of a little story about that, because okay. When that hit the airwaves, there was a good bit of comment on that, especially on the Internet. So much so that Petraeus, being a very political animal, thought he had to make sure that no one misunderstood that he was a full supporter of Israel. And what happened here is an email exchange which Petraeus inadvertently sent to the wrong person. What happened was a person out there in California who feels strongly about the Israeli-Palestinian problem wrote him a little email saying, you know, that is terrific, General. Finally, somebody of your stature has pointed out that without solving the Israeli-Palestinian issue, our troops are more at danger. Now, what happened next, and this is really kind of amusing, Petraeus sent back a little note which he said, "That's fine, yeah, thank you very much for your expression of support, but we're downplaying this now, and, you know, thanks, but no thanks, okay?" What Petraeus forgot to do was to delete a whole train of messages which were attached to that message he sent to this fellow in California.
Oh, ouch.
Which showed that as soon as the internet started buzzing with Petraeus' point about Israeli obstructionism putting our troops in danger, he sent an email to Max Boot. Now, who's Max Boot? Well, he's an arch neoconservative, just about as far right as you can be. He's now at the Council of Foreign Relations, but he was the op-ed editor of the Wall Street Journal. Anyhow, he says, now, Max, am I in trouble? I didn't say that. It was just in my written testimony. I never said that Israel is making it more difficult. You know, am I in trouble? And Max said, no, it's okay, Dave. Don't worry about it. I'm writing an article now, the title of which is Petraeus is Not Anti-Semitic. And that should do
Oh,
it.
My God.
The next email from Petraeus, are you sure? Do you think I should make a statement? You know, I hosted Elie Wiesel and his wife at dinner last week, and next week I'm going to meet with Holocaust survivors. Do you think I should get that out in a press release? Max Boot says, no, look, nobody's calling you anti-Semitic now. I wrote my article. Just cool it, Dave. Everything's okay. And Petraeus says, thanks, Max. And doesn't he put a little colon in one of those parentheses, you know, the smile face?
Right.
We have it. I mean, it's right out there. We even wrote about it on consortiumnews.com. So what's the point? The point is that anyone who wants to make it, and I think that Petraeus has presidential aspirations, and I wouldn't even rule out the fact that they might go to him given the feckless group that they have on the Republican ticket now. He has these ambitions and he knows that he's got to play ball and he can't. He can't possibly make a mistake such as Howard Dean did when he was the front runner. Do you remember? He said publicly something that is verboten. He said, you know, I think maybe our policy in the Middle East might be more even-handed. Wow. Didn't they jump on him? Next thing you know, they take out of context some angry moments he had during his speech, and he was out of there. So it's a very formidable lobby. It's a very formidable problem. The problem is that those who care about Israel, and I do, those who care about Israel realize that this is unsustainable, that the more that they strike out might makes right, the more they repress the Palestinians, the less possible it's going to be for them to continue to exist. Because what they have now is a major, major change in the strategic situation. What they have now is a country to their south. The name is Egypt, 75 million people. It used to be no threat at all to the Israeli government because the U.S. was paying off Mubarak and others, and the Israelis had no reason to be concerned about its southern flank. Now look at it. 75 million people who care about the Palestinians and are trying to open the land border to Gaza. What do they have to the north? They have Turkey. It used to be a close ally. Because of what the Israelis did in shooting up the Turkish ship last year, tensions are very, very high with Turkey. And their prime minister just said today that there can be no improvement in relations until Israel apologizes for the attack on the Turkish ship and gives restitution to the victims, okay? So Turkey, Egypt, what about the surrounding areas? Well, we know what happened on the anniversary of the Nakba, the driving out of Palestinians from the territory in 1948. On the anniversary this year, Palestinians congregated at all the borders there, Lebanon, Syria, and Syria, they crossed the border. And so this is sort of nonviolent kind of thing, which the Israeli authorities really don't know how to handle. And if they're going to shoot up people, well, there will be some cameras around, and it will get an even blacker eye. So they may be able to pull Obama around by a string for a little bit longer, but sooner or later, the Americans and others are going to wake up and say, you know, this is not healthy for us, and it's certainly not even healthy for the Israeli people, because they're not going to be able to persist in this kind of policy.
Right. You know, I was going to ask you that. It's extremely academic, but do you have any time frame on when this might happen? Like I said, it is extremely academic, but based on your almost three decades in the Central Intelligence Agency as an analyst, do you have any feel for how it's unfolding, how it's evolving, when it might happen?
Well, I have no crystal ball, and it depends on so many variables, but let me put it this way. There's a major juncture coming up in September when it looks like the Palestinians would be able to get some kind of recognition of a Palestinian state by the UN General Assembly. That may seem, you know, sort of, well, big deal, but it is a big deal. And if that happens, and the U.S. can be depended upon to to do everything they can to block it. But this isn't the Security Council. This is the General Assembly. It seems to be likely that that will pass. The repercussions of that will be kind of a demonstration of how isolated Israel and the United States are, and that's bound to have repercussions. I don't think this can last very much longer. The hope that I have is that a resolution will be found along the lines of what happened in South Africa with apartheid. I was very much surprised, happily surprised, that there was a peaceful outcome of that situation. I never thought it would happen, frankly, but it did. There were some statesmanlike people, and they did statesmanlike activity, okay? Now, I don't see that in the present Israeli government, but governments change, and the times may require a kind of Israeli government, which they have had from time to time in the past, they'll realize that it would be suicidal to continue these policies and that gradually a peaceful solution can be found, all the more so since the Palestinians are behaving in a nonviolent way for the most part, with an errant missile here and there done by the real extremists, and some people suspect maybe Mossad, the Israeli spy agency itself, as a provocation. But it's very volatile. The problem is that Obama feels that he has his hands tied when he said the obvious, that the Israelis should go back to the borders before their expansive war in 1967, which of course is what the UN Resolution 242 in late November 1967 required of Israel. You know, he's careful to say with certain adjustments mutually agreed upon. And Netanyahu comes to town and thumbs his nose at the president next to Congress as though he's the president. So, you know, that's chutzpah that's not going to work over the longer run. And for the Israelis themselves, I just hope that they come to their senses and work out a decent arrangement which will let the Palestinians live in the kind of peace and security that everyone aspires to.
Ray McGovern, I want to thank you so much for the time you took out explaining all this to the listeners, and thanks for doing what you're doing. You're a great man.
Thank you very much. Bye now.
Thanks, Ray.